Welcome everyone to another episode of Sunship Podcast. It's my pleasure today to welcome my friend Stephen Hill. Stephen is an Irishman who has just returned home to Ireland from New Zealand, but we'll get into that anyway. So let me introduce you to Stephen Hill. Stephen, welcome.
Hey John, good to be here.
It's good to have you, mate. Lovely to see you.
Yes, good to see you.
It's obviously how's done you well.
How's Bonnie Scotland? How's Bonnie Scotland?
Grey and wet.
All right. Well, at least we're not wet. We're slightly grey here, but not wet, which is great.
That kind of matches my hair, you know.
Yeah.
Stephen, I mean, obviously some of the folks listening are going to know who you are, but there'll be lots who don't. So give us a little potted biography of Stephen Hill.
Okay. Yeah, the movie's coming out next year, so I'll give you a brief synopsis. Anyway, I'm from Belfast in Northern Ireland, and I was born an increasing number of years ago. It's getting scary. But yeah, I grew up in a family of five, right when the troubles were kicking off, you know, so I remember sort of hearing gunshots and all that, you know, in the distance and all that sort of stuff. I suppose for those people who don't know me, the unique thing about me is that I was brought up in the Plymouth Brethren, the exclusive branch of the Plymouth Brethren, which was extremely strict. Looking back on it, I thought it was normal, but I soon discovered later on that it wasn't, you know. But so I was brought up in that as a young child, and my grandfather was pretty high up in it, although there wasn't actually any hierarchy officially, you know, but he was well respected in it. But so, yeah, I was brought up in that, and it obviously had a deep impact on my life, because I was brought up going to loads of Christian meetings and stuff like that, you know, on a Sunday, and was brought up without TV or radio. And then when I went to school, there was things that everyone else was allowed to do, but I wasn't allowed to do. So I developed a sort of a pride, but also a shame, which are sort of two sides of one coin, actually, I've realized. But then, so I sort of evolved through that, was really dedicated to it. I didn't really go through the teenage rebellion. But then when I was in my 20s, I began to get really hungry for something deeper spiritually. And I had a sort of an experience which would have been termed then the baptism of the Spirit. And I found myself in the charismatic movement in a big church in Belfast, called Christian Fellowship Church. Robin Mark, who wrote Days of Elijah, was the worship leader there. So I went through all that in the 90s and all. I've had a number of crises. So the big thing then, another huge shift for me was in 2007, where I hit a wall and burnt out. And my Christianity that I thought was sort of mature, spirit-led, anointed, sort of hit the wall. And it didn't fizzle out. It went out with a bang, really, because of some circumstances in my life. And I found myself in a sort of a sexual connection with someone that I'd known years ago. I mean, I was a single person at the time, but it was a big wake-up call for me, because the other person was married and lived in England. But so it was a huge sort of shock to me. But I realized that there was nothing internally in me. There was nothing to stop, you know, to stop me just falling headlong into the temptation. Mm. And that around that time, someone introduced me to the teaching of James Jordan, and I wasn't really that impressed with it. It was a CD, but over a period of time, and in this deepening spiral of crisis in my life, I really began to something sort of got into me there, and then, and this is sort of coming to the end of the brief potted history. Then I began to just sort of look at the website of this ministry called Father Heart Ministries that James Jordan was involved in. And I saw this thing in New Zealand, 3-month school. And I was actually really bored with a lot of Christian stuff, you know. But some of the stuff they were talking about sort of caught my interest a little bit. And I applied to go to it, not thinking I would actually be accepted, but I actually, to my surprise, was accepted. So I had to make a sort of a life-changing choice and sign up for this thing in 2008. And it was a 3 months over in New Zealand. And I had a sort of a profound shift there, more emotionally than theologically, in a sense, but it was connected in sort of theologically, I suppose. But so I really came into, I had a deep psychological healing, John, and
wow.
And a sort of a paradigm shift to go with that. And so since that, I then sort of came back to Belfast in a state of what I would only call bliss, extreme bliss. And I worked for about a year, and then I was invited back out to staff on the next school out in New Zealand. So went back out there, and that's where I met Becky, who I'm now married to. And I've sort of been in New Zealand ever since that, and been involved in with James and Denise Jordan and sort of things like ghostwriting their books, and then written some of my own. So I've been there right up until the very end of last year, when we returned here to Belfast as a family, back to my home place. But obviously, for Becky, my wife, she's a New Zealander. And we have two children, Jacob, who's 11, and Jesse, who's 9. And they were born in New Zealand, so they're back here. So that sort of brings us up to date with the broad uh-huh. brush of where I'm at.
Wow.
Yeah,
so, I mean, I can only imagine the detail.
Yes, but, I know. There's a huge amount of detail. Yes, yeah, exactly.
But I'm interested in something you said, Stephen. You spoke about the two sides of the coin of shame and pride. How did that? How did those things manifest in your life?
Well, for example, they started manifesting, and you know, in the like of school, when I wasn't allowed to do some things that I really wanted to do, because I was always really interested in literature, you know, and drama and stuff like that. But I wasn't allowed to do those because they were sort of seen as worldly, with inverted commas. And because, you know, literature is always a huge threat to people who don't, you know. So, and I'm not blaming my father anymore. I've actually, I don't feel bitterness at all about that, but that was the reality. And then we weren't allowed to go to school assemblies or do religious education classes,
wow.
You see.
Wow.
So, yeah, because my parents were afraid, and the church that we were in were afraid of us getting sort of contaminated by those sort of things. So basically I had to sort of sit outside when everyone was at school assembly.
Wow.
So I felt deeply ashamed in front of the other kids, you see, but I sort of compensated within myself, John, with thinking, oh, I'm actually closer to God than them. I've got a more pure form. So that's why shame and pride were these two sides of the one coin. I mean, now I know that it was just my sort of feeling of being superior was actually just an inverted form of feeling inferior, you know.
So like a compensatory kind of thing.
Yes, it's sort of a compensatory thing. And that's, I mean, so I've got quite a lot of insight into that. And, you know, when you feel really embarrassed, you have to you've got to compensate within yourself. I mean, I wasn't a particularly boisterous or dominant kid, so I didn't fight against the other kids or anything, but So I put all that stuff inside myself, and I suppose for many years that was sort of my default drug, if you like, was to get a high on this feeling of religious superiority, you know.
Do you think, I mean, was that something that would have been common amongst the denomination you were part of, or do you think it's something that's just common to Christianity?
Probably the answer is yes to all of that. I mean, I think... I've got to be absolutely honest and say that yes, I'm having huge shifts in what I view about Christianity, but I think, my basic analysis in the sense of Christianity is that I suppose we're all trying to find what it really actually is, but I do think there's a lot of, and rightly so, in some ways, people, we're all very broken and we need help we need something to get security from. But there's a lot of basically psychological insecurities, I suppose, that are then covered up with some sort of terminology or some feeling of feeling better than the other person. And I think that actually goes for right and left wing political or whatever. You know, there's no, I don't think anybody necessarily, you know, if you take things over a broad span.
Yeah,
maybe the fundamentalists in a sense have had the they've been able to feel superior and it's things are shifting now, but I don't necessarily believe. I think when we're all orphan, we always try and compensate whatever way, just for our insecurities, you know, and that's a very human thing. Mm.
So how has that shifted for you, Stephen, from being in that place of feeling ashamed and compensating with a sense of pride? How does that shift for you, and how did it happen?
Well, I think it happened, John, because I did sort of have all I can say was I had a sort of a supernatural encounter, but it wasn't like something that dropped out of the heavens. You know, I've had that sort of thing, but when I was out in New Zealand, and I sort of the first thing that really impacted me was not actually this teaching from this couple, James and Denise Jordan. It was actually that they were very vulnerable about their own lives. You know, and they had said that they had been deeply burned out, you see. So right away I could identify with that, you know, and I love this. I've become a very vulnerable person myself, you know, because a lot of people in churches as we've known it will never be vulnerable enough.
No.
And so you can't identify. You always think the person's got it all together. And I knew people like that. I had a good friend and I always thought he really had it all together. And then we had a sort of a
I was taught that at Bible college, Stephen.
Yes.
But don't make yourself vulnerable to your congregation.
Well, yes, exactly. Well, I had this really good friend and I worked with him, and he was always immaculately dressed. And every time he came into the office, he would say, "I'm in tip-top form," you see. So anyway, one day our whole relationship shifted because he asked me to help him carry a huge storage heater, you know, with the bricks in it.
Oh, yeah.
Up about five flights of stairs to an office, you see.
Creaky.
And halfway, it was the heaviest thing I've ever carried, you see. And halfway up the stairs, I sort of stumbled. And we were so extreme in our discomfort physically. And he sort of shouted at me. And I swore back at him, you see. But by the time we got to the top of the stairs, our whole relationship was transformed.
Wow.
Because the sort of that whole thing had been, that veneer had broken down.
Yeah.
But he then told me, and this is my point, he then told me a while later that he was actually bipolar.
Wow.
So, and then I had suffered from depression and an anxiety more myself, but that actually transformed our relationship, that we were able to identify with one another. So that's the big thing that really opened me up to start off, was to receive what was being said from the front, is that these people that I met, this couple, James and Denise Jordan, were very vulnerable about their own burnout and their own struggles with doing the Christian life, so to speak. So that sort of opened me up, and I thought, yeah, these people know what it's like. They know what my life has been like in some ways.
Yeah.
So that sort of, then that sort of opened me up to just to have these paradigm shifts that happen through the teaching. And I do think that that is important, whatever way it comes, but we do need paradigm shifts for whenever the emotions go up and down, you know, because I'm actually a very emotional person, very driven by my emotions. So that was the beginning of a paradigm shift for me, John. But I have to say this, that, you know, the brethren upbringing for me was very negative and all, but there was actually an underlying theology behind it that it wasn't Calvinist.
Right. That's interesting, because most people would imagine that it would be.
People, yeah. I hear all these people sort of saying, oh, you know, I heard someone saying recently, no, we deserve to be rejected by God. You see, that's sort of that's a terrible thing, but it's to me, it's heresy, but that comes from a sort of a Calvinist thing. But in the Brethren thing, we didn't do, because the Brethren came out of the Anglican movement, Anglican church. Mm. So that wasn't, but so the basic, if you actually read a lot of the hymns that we sung, which I actually enjoy because I love poetry, a lot of them were based in the sort of purpose of God to have humans before him without accusation, holy and blameless in love. And that's the starting point. So I've sort of come back to that foundation, you know, that God's that God's disposition towards us is actually the beginning point, is that he actually wants us and that we do deserve to be loved by him, you know. And so that's why I've sort of written that latest book.
I was going to say, you wrote a book called You Deserve the Love of God, haven't you?
Yeah, yes, because I started winding me up, this thing, these people singing stuff. You know, you love us so much, but we don't deserve it, you know. And my kids would never think that, you know, we don't deserve to be loved by Dad, you know. So that's why I wrote that book. And it's still I think it's a massive thing that has to be shifted, to be honest. You know?
So where can people get that book, Stephen?
Well, off Amazon, and or else you can get it off my own website, which is www.ancientfuture.co.nz. And John may put a link down below or something, but it's available on Amazon.
But that's not the only book you've written. That's just the latest one.
No, that's the latest one. I'm struggling with a couple more at the minute. I've written actually about six books myself, and they've done pretty well. I've just written more out of my own stuff, and a lot of it's very biblical in a sense, because I just happen to sort of know the Bible quite well, just from my, I've had to get as much revelation as in it, but I knew it well enough because I've got a very retentive mind for literature and stuff, and I've always really loved reading, so I don't want to overplay that, you know.
With the Brethren, that's a huge thing. Is
yes, exactly.
The Bible. Know the Bible, stand on the Word.
Yeah, so, true. So it was good for a pub quiz. But I'm having huge shifts in how I read it, and I do read. I have read quite a bit of theology over the years, but I don't do that so much now. I'm trying to get more of my own perspective on things, but I'm determined to sort of face the Bible and wrestle with it. I sort of know enough now that, I've had a love-hate relationship with the Bible. In many ways, I still do, but I do think we have to understand it. It's almost like I use this illustration quite recently, that the Bible in a way is like nature. It's not simple, right? No. Some parts of it are dangerous. Some parts of it are very nice, you know. So you could go out and look at a huge big wave sea, you know, but the Bible's like that, and so we can't really claim to understand all of it, you know. But I'm sort of determined, well, not determined, but I'm it's something that I cannot move away from. It's just, so I can't brush it under the carpet, I can't ignore it, but yet I don't accept so much that has been said about it. So that's why I started writing a lot about it, and I'm trying to get into these biblical books to try and make some sort of sense, because the old evangelical arguments don't hold any water anymore. But yet, for me, you can't dismiss these ancient texts out of hand either, you know. So I'm sort of caught in the middle of that. The old evangelical arguments in the Bible, just they don't hold water. We can't use them, but yet at the same time, for me personally, we cannot just throw the thing out because I don't believe we can dismiss the ancient, because the ancients are a lot more intelligent, you know, whether the ancient First Nations people or the ancient Hebrew writers, you know what I mean? So,
Yeah, I think we make the mistake of thinking, well, they were ignorant back then.
No, I don't think so.
And they weren't. Yeah,
that's a very arrogant way of thinking. I actually think, apart from the religious thing, I mean, the engineering knowledge of the ancient Egyptians and all, they knew a lot more than what we know. And the relationship between nature, creation, and the human person, they knew a lot more. So I'm a little bit cynical of the Enlightenment and of scientific advances. And I think the whole COVID thing has shown up science to have gone as far as it can. So we do need to, I do think personally, I'm very interested in wrestling with ancient wisdom. So that's sort of the way I would approach the Bible in a sense, is that these ancient people knew some that we don't know. But yet I don't take that sort of evangelical view of it either. So I'm trying to find a way in between the two. Yeah.
It's interesting. I read something recently where someone said, you know, a lot of people know their Bible, but they don't understand what it's saying.
Yeah, true, true.
And I do read,
I have read a lot of theologians, a very wide. So in terms of reading, I'm not insecure. I'll read anything and everything, you know, whether it's Christian or not, you know, but at the moment when I'm trying to read my own, write my own stuff, I've sort of stopped reading a lot of what other people say because I want to try and get a unique perspective on things. So that's sort of where I'm at with writing. Yeah.
I look forward to seeing what comes out of that then.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to my friend and yours, Jim Hall, the other day. About 3 hours with him, about just a couple of days ago. And I was telling him about my book in John's Gospel, you see, and said, you know, it's got a lot of really good reviews, you see, but it's sort of hanging like a big shadow over me. I'm scared to put another book. And he said to me, because Jim's a real music fan, he says to me, it's like Van Morrison's Astral Weeks, you know, this sort of album, you know. So I'm sort of this sort of.
How do you follow that?
Exactly, John. That's what I'm struggling with. So I'm trying. I've got a lot of good insight, but I'm just desperate to get the words to. And I suppose you're a sort of a prolific writer.
But you get insecure about it, thinking.
Oh, you do. Yes. Exactly.
Really?
Yes, I know. Yeah. Yes, is there some way I can put that differently? You know, kind of sex that up to make it sort of more appealing. Because the worst, and you would know this, the worst thing for a writer is to be boring. Doesn't matter.
Oh my goodness. No. But you mentioned something before about when we're all orphaned. What did you mean by that, Stephen?
Well, again, I mean, this is the sort of one of the default paradigms that I came to realize through listening to James Jordan, that basically the whole of creation has lost connection with the source, the father, mother, if you like, that original parent. And that's at a deep level, in many ways, physically, psychologically, spiritually, emotionally. I suppose to use some, it's sort of like almost like an archetype, if you like. It's like this deep sense of being disconnected and having no source. And so that's as the ancient text would say, which I said instead of now the Bible, as the ancient text would have said, you know, where Jesus said in this ancient text, "I do not leave you as orphans." So basically, the default for many of us in our experiences that we've lost connection with the source. But I'm now beginning to see that before that we actually did belong. So we have to rediscover that the very foundational status of creation and the human race is a state of belonging. Longing, not orphanness, you know. And that's where all these Calvinists and all get it so wrong, because they begin with the fall, if you like, but that's not the beginning. They begin with this big, the cosmic disruption, but actually the beginning point, I believe, is a place of belonging, not division. You know, it's unity is at the beginning. So that's where we
That makes sense of Paul's plea for reconciliation, then, doesn't it?
That does, John. It does. I mean, and the more I read people like Paul through my own perspective of feeling a belonging now, I see so much in different ways. You know, Pete, these guys, so I mean, and some of this stuff I'm writing about is that, you know, if you look at things through the perspective and the paradigm of feeling loved and feeling a belonging, you can see it popping out all over the place, rather than a feeling of being deeply disconnected. And I do think we all have to come back to the basic idea that, and Christianity is to blame for a lot of this, but we're actually much closer connected to nature, the animals, the birds, the trees, and all, than what we think.
Yeah.
Anyway,
definitely.
Yeah. So I'm even beginning to see that.
The more I speak to people, Stephen, the more I'm understanding that.
Yes.
That people feel the connection when they're out in the woods and there's no one else around.
Exactly.
Or they're sitting on the shore watching the waves, and they feel it creates some sense of being part of something huge.
Yes, so we have to close that gap again. And you know, and so my journey has been a journey of closing the gaps. And also I've sort of come to reconcile with my own self, my own humanness, which I tried to run away from for many, many years. It's fascinating to talk about all this stuff.
How do you mean, Stephen, like your own humanness?
Well, you see, again, in that book, You Deserve the Love of God, I say that in 2008, I began to have two reconciliations, a sort of a double reconciliation. I was reconciled with God as a loving God, you see, but I also... The flip side of that was I began to be reconciled with myself. You know, I began to just accept myself and have a healthy, I suppose you could say, a healthy self-image, you know. So I began to integrate more with my own human self, you know.
Wow.
So I began to integrate more, and I love to say, I began to face my shadow and my dark side and not trying to escape from it, you know.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I've been on a huge journey with John, you know, to get rid of this sort of split. I had a sort of a split down my personality, if you like, about between the sacred and the secular, the holy and the profane, but that's all coming together now in a more of a harmony.
Well, because I guess Christianity or any religion does that, doesn't it? But, you know, you need to be holy, you need to...
Yes.
Whatever, and but you know that there are these parts of you that are not holy.
No,
you know,
true.
You have sexual fantasies, or you have unnatural desires, or you just want to eat too much, or drink too much, that creates the shame then, doesn't it?
And there's also an inner violence with that in most religion that. So, for example, if I have an addiction, which I suppose I have, but more in terms of, say, eating too much or sugar or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's an inner violence in that. And I've learned that if you're too aggressive against yourself, you shoot yourself in the foot. You know, there's these vicious cycles. Excuse me. There's these vicious cycles you go into. And a lot of this stuff comes from, without getting too much into it, a lot of the ancient peoples and the Hebrew peoples and all didn't think this way. You know, we've been very influenced too by Western ways of thinking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And sort of Greek philosophy and all that stuff. So people didn't really think in the same ways as we think. So, I mean, that's been a big eye-opener to me, that so much of our influence and my own influence was nothing to do with religion or God. It was sort of... in the culture as well.
Culture,
you know?
Yeah. Well, because the Hebrews saw themselves much more as an integrated whole, didn't they?
They did, you say
they
did.
They saw
yes.
everything in terms of relationship, not
they did.
As in them necessarily.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and it's all, again, a lot of our Christianity has been far too much up in the head about what you think or what you believe and it's sort of in your mind, but we haven't a clue how to make it embodied in any way, you know?
Yeah.
So...
fascinating. Wow.
Yeah, so this is just, these are just ways that I'm sort of thinking at the moment a bit, you know.
But I think this is the thing, Stephen, is when we start to voice the things that we're thinking, we start to discover that there are other people on that same path,
on that same track,
maybe in different places, you know. But because I think sometimes when you start to come into these paradigm shifts, you think you're alone.
Yes.
You think, I know certainly when I started coming into that whole place, again, because of James's ministry, James Jordan's ministry.
Yeah.
That I, you know, over the years, I come to points where I think, am I just becoming a crazy man or a heretic?
Yes.
You know, because that surely this can't, what I'm thinking can't be real because my whole life I've been taught this.
But one thing that I find increasingly, John, when I write stuff or I go and talk at different places, that people say that what I say is not new, but what I'm giving is words to what people are feeling and I can't articulate it, you know? Yeah. So that sort of encourages me. And I think that's why people need people like you and me. But I do think we all have to bounce off each other. We need connection. Yeah. So therefore, when you and me chat, you know, we can just immediately fall into a connection and, you know, we can sort of understand each other, you know. So I think there's a lot of safety in that. I think actually it's dangerous when, see, this is why I'm very much against people, one person hogging everything. You know?
Yeah.
I think there's a much greater safety in the equality of the group. Yes. You know, on a flattened, that's why hierarchies are actually very dangerous to me, because everyone's held hostage to one person, you know, and their understanding, whereas in a group and a balance of things, you know, I don't even like the word truth, but the reality exists in the relationship between you, me, and others, you know.
That's the problem, isn't it? A lot of our theology, a lot of our doctrines and beliefs have been created not out of relationship, but out of the mind.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And then you find that they don't work in reality because they don't fit into relationship paradigms.
That's right. And again, that's been my journey. That I know a lot of people, and I don't blame them, who have sort of given up because.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them at all. I think it's actually quite a healthy thing because whatever they had believed in their mind has not actually been able to be transferred into real life, you know?
And it becomes, I think it's interesting when, again, I remember, I don't know who came out with it, but, you know, someone said, like, I've just become disillusioned with church and Christianity. And the reply that was given to them was, well, what was the illusion that you believed?
But at the same time, I do believe there is a truth there. There is a foundational reality there, but it has to be rediscovered. And that's sort of really where I'm at. You know, that's why the old evangelical things are not really, don't wash anymore because there's too much of a credibility gap there. But yet throwing the whole thing out doesn't really wash any either. But we have to reconnect. And that's why I'm determined as we have to reconnect the things that were said in the ancient texts, if you like, back with our experience and so on, and find the reality there. Yeah. So, man, that's an ongoing journey for everyone, I suppose.
Yeah. It's that there so often, Stephen, I find myself in this liminal space where it's like I am leaving stuff behind, but I haven't quite managed to reach out far enough to grab
life itself is probably a liminal space, you know, we're always going to be that. But at the same time, I don't expect everyone to be theologians either, you know, that's wrong too, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, people say that to me when I'm talking, they say, well, you're the theologian. I was like, no, I'm not.
I'm not
a theologian. Not by a long chalk.
Yes, I know.
I read theologians and I have to look up I have to do Google searches to see what words mean. I don't know, what do these words mean?
Yes, I know, exactly.
I think that's why I write the way I do, to try and make it simple, to try and simplify it.
But you're actually a very gifted writer, you know, I mean, so when's your next book coming out?
I don't know, I'm working on two or three different things.
Yes, well, that's the way I am at the moment.
Just wrestling with how do I shape this.
Yeah, somebody said, I read somewhere recently, somebody says, you write a book, you start in the middle and fight your way out. That's very good, actually.
That's just about it, yeah.
Yes, yes.
You have this idea and then you think,
yeah, how the heck?
About, yes, what do yes. I say about this idea? Oh, wow. So you've relocated back to Belfast, Stephen, and, yes, I know yes. that wasn't done just because you fancied a change of scenery. But
yeah,
how did you come to the decision?
Well, what actually happened was I've always struggled a little bit with living in New Zealand. I think anyone who comes from Europe, there's a real sense of isolation at a very sort of... It's a beautiful country, but as I said before, the first time I went down to Wellington, which is the capital at the bottom of the North Island, if I was a flat earth believer, I would have thought I was going to fall off the edge. but I'm not a flat earth believer. But no, it's very... And I also struggled a lot. The sun is extremely harsh and bright there, and I'm very sensitive to the sun. But I had no intention of moving back here. I was sort of content with it. But then one day I said to my wife, Becky, I just have this strong desire to walk the streets of Belfast, you know, you see. So I sort of thought I'd maybe go over for a month or something. And then a few weeks later, Becky said to me, I think we should move to Belfast.
Wow.
You know? So it came from
Becky?
Yeah, well, the big thing came from her, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And basically, wow. And I sort of said to her, you know what, I would love to move back to Belfast, you know, because, and one of the things was because our children, it was to give our children a sense of where I've come from and an experience of being with my family over here for a period of time, you know.
Yeah.
So we're here for a number of years anyway, and I personally don't really miss New Zealand as a country. I obviously miss people, but I'm very content. I think whenever you move away anywhere, you're going to miss somebody somewhere. Yes. So amazingly, since we made that decision, so many things have come so easily. It hasn't been a battle at all. It's been... there's been huge swathes of money have come to us. There have been things started really flowing. The doors have opened so easily. And so that's why we have come back. And it's not really for any... I reject that it's anything to do with ministry. It's more to do with family. But on the other hand, it does... I love being back in Europe. I think I'm actually... I don't know that my stuff, whatever I carry... it's less relevant. It's more relevant here in Europe, actually, than anywhere, I think.
Interesting.
Because I think I have something to say to the cycle of church history where Europe is at rather than where Asia is at, you know. So
yeah.
I think whatever I have is something to say in these sort of post-evangelical, post-charismatic eras and stuff. That's more where I fit in, and that's where I feel it's something to say.
Yeah.
And in places like, and I've been to Asia and all, they're lovely people, but I was not sure that they actually got what I was saying or that I was able to. So I think I'm sort of ideally fitted to where everyone is, where Europe is at. So being here actually gives me a lot more access easily to just jump on a flight to.
Yeah.
Holland or Norway or whatever, or go to Scotland or something. But I mean, also we would like to try and just bed ourselves back into Ireland here.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, like, you can reach anywhere in Europe within 4 or 5 hours.
No, it's just fantastic.
Yes, the furthest reaches, you're 4 or 5 hours. From New Zealand, you're talking 16, 17, 18 hours.
Exactly.
You know?
Yes, exactly. And I always had to stay overnight. In Hong Kong or Singapore, so it's very, very difficult. Yeah. So, and Europe is really, I suppose, where my heart really is. And, you know, even though Becky misses her family and all, and I don't want to speak on her behalf, but it has been proved. I actually think coming to Ireland has helped to draw, because Becky's a very creative person, and Belfast is actually a very creative place.
Yes.
So it's helping to draw something out of her that she wouldn't really get. expression in New Zealand, you know.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
And I think the same will be for the kids. I mean, the kids are young, but I think that they will find that being in Belfast will bring out parts of them that New Zealand can't bring out.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So,
wow. Yeah. And I think, I mean, you're saying, you know, New Zealand's a beautiful country and all that, but when you look properly at Ireland, in Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland,
Yes, it's, when the sun's out, it's just nowhere nicer. Well, maybe Scotland, you know, but and places like Norway are lovely.
I think Northern Ireland and Scotland are very similar, even in landscape and everything.
Oh, yes, they are. Yeah. So I really love it here and the family. My wife Becky says for the first time in her life she can actually look up at the sky because the sky is so bright in New Zealand. You've got to keep your eyes down, you know. But she, Becky really loves, she's a bit of an artist and she really loves the skies here.
She'll get great light for drawing and painting then.
Oh, it's fantastic. And now that the as we say here, the nights are on the turn, that things are getting brighter again. It's she loves looking at it, you know. So,
we've talked a little bit in general about what's been happening with you and the shift that's going on. I mean, is there anything specific that's stirring your heart right now, Steve?
I think, I do think that what is stirring in my heart, John, is it's actually, I'm not sure where to put all this, but I really love this whole thing. I want to see people empowered. I want to sort of discover a community, I suppose spiritual community in some ways, that where there's a sort of an egalitarianism in a sense, but that all people's giftings come out. And I'm not sure if I've got the ability for that, but it's really big on my heart. I would love to sort of, I suppose I'd love to sort of express myself more within a sort of a local community, but I'm not convinced and I'm not sure how Christian to make it. I mean, this is a little bit controversial, but I do wonder now, I'm not really trying to convert anyone in a sense. I'm more trying to convert myself, but I almost think by default, we're all Christian in that sense. And I don't like that word, but I said something recently that I don't really believe Christianity is something that we buy into or we have to convert to. I actually think it's actually how the universe works. You know what I mean? It's actually if we really understood, it's the deepest explanation for how life is or the universe. And we have to, it's about sort of more aligning to that, you know, or that the universe really works through love, you see. So to be absolutely honest, you know, and there's some really good theologians now that I would agree with. And they're orthodox too, in a way. They're not, so I don't put myself in the sort of fundamentalist camp both ways, either the really sort of deconstructionist liberal camp, and I don't put myself in the sort of conservative. I'm trying to find a different way of doing things, you know. But I do believe that I don't know. I would just love to. I think me and Becky would love to, when we move into our new house, we're going to just try and just do things, not just out of our hearts, you know. If our heart overflows to go and help a neighbor, we want to do that. If our heart overflows to go and give compassion to somebody, we want to do that. And I also want to sort of express myself more, not even only in terms of writing, teaching, but I also love singing, for example.
And I've really? I never knew that.
Exactly, you know, but that's the thing, you know. But I've actually, my voice used to sort of tremble a lot when I sung, but I've actually started finding it more resonant. And I actually love things like drama and stuff like that. So
drama's good.
I think our biggest battle is the battle to be ourselves, you know. Yeah. So, and I think you probably identify with that. I'm not fully
very
myself.
Much. There's very still. Much.
So I think that's the biggest battle in many ways, is the battle to be true to ourselves. Uh-huh. So that's sort of, I just want to continue to be true to myself. And I think being back in Ireland is it's a redemptive thing for me, that I can come back and live here without the old divisions within myself, yes. The old dichotomies, you know, that I can go and explore things because I want to explore them, that I can live without the shame, you know, and stuff like that, that I can live a redeemed and reconciled life, you know. Wow. And that I can speak clearly to people that I was ashamed and sort of put on airs and graces to before, or what you would call fig leaves, or even told lies to people, or not spoke really the truth, you know, and dressed it up in religious ways, but it was actually lies, you know.
Yeah.
But so to be back here is just to be living more authentically. Wow. And it's very, very redemptive for me, John, you know, because, you know, I've left for 13 years. And when I left, I hadn't been living authentically, probably ever. Mm. But now I'm sort of seeking to redress that and sort of live more authentically.
And I think when you start to do that, Stephen, because I'm kind of in a similar place to you, where it's like, as you start to be that person,
yes,
that's when you desire community more.
Yes, exactly.
You know, because I'm the same. I'm thinking like, okay, how do we do this? Because I don't want to start a Christian church or Christian gathering, but I want to have a community around me where we can talk about spiritual stuff.
Yes, exactly, you know? John. That's exactly where I'm at. You know, so yeah, it's quite interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think we're all on the cusp of this sort of thing. We're all looking at this. And I'm long enough in the tooth now where I'm not going to do anything out of it. I'm not trying to build anything or put hooks into people, you know.
Yeah.
I just want to be authentic, really, and then liberate other people to be authentic.
Yeah. So. I think the first realization on the whole authenticity thing for me was reading some of Brené Brown's stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You know, she's big on that authenticity and vulnerability. And that really frightened the life out of me.
Yes, it is.
Being authentic and being vulnerable.
Well, that's what I'm sort of even facing. You know, I think we always have to sort of step into these areas that frighten the life out of us, you know. And again, it's sort of I think it's going to be an ongoing thing, but I've learned to recognize fear, but to not allow it to hold me back, to step into the space where fear is and see some shift, you know. Because I was very fascinated with your podcast with Fiona last week. I thought it was fantastic, you know. I loved it. And some of the things that Fiona was saying that, you know, the big question is will this give me life, you know? And that's sort of where I'm at.
I remember when she talked about that, and that just blew my mind. She asked me, do you think this is God? And I was like, that's the voice of the Father right there.
So we have to, we're sort of right out on the edge, a lot of us, you know, but it's good. I feel quite good about it, you know. I'm in quite a good place at the moment, you know. I think I feel a lot more secure, I suppose, with being back in the place that's familiar to me, and everybody has the same sense of humour and all, you know.
Yeah.
So the boots on the other foot a little bit for Becky and the kids. They've had to adjust more, but they're doing pretty well, you know. But I feel good about being back here.
So good. So where do you see the future, Stephen, of religion, Christianity, faith? How do you see that?
I think I will continue to explore. I still believe in the good news, you know.
I
do believe in the Bible, but not in the way people might think. But my future is to continue to explore and to continue to speak out and be authentic and write. I want to continue speaking, writing. I want to continue holding the Bible as a sacred book, you know, and a book in which there is life and which cannot be dismissed. But I also want to, I want to spend a life really in getting revelation and interpreting the Bible from a completely different perspective, from a place of love, basically, or being loved. And I wouldn't even say, again, and everybody has different views of what that means. But again, I think I just see myself as continuing to be a communicator, writing, speaking. I would actually love to even do a few little films. I sort of love to try a documentary or something, you know. So I sort of love that whole side of things. I love communications. I sort of love the arts and all of that stuff.
Because I want to say, doing something like that with documentary film, that's quite creative.
Yeah.
No, but it combines all of those skills, doesn't it?
Well, I'd even thought of doing a mini documentary myself around, because we live in the area that C.S. Lewis grew up in. So it's all loads of stuff around. So I thought of even getting Becky to, because she's quite a good to do the filming on the iPhone, and I would speak and we would go around a few places and stick it up on YouTube, you know. So,
cool.
Yeah, so quite interesting.
Keep my eye out for that.
Yeah, so I might get doing some of this stuff, yeah.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, so that's sort of where I'm at. And then obviously being a dad is it's a challenge too and a joy, but I mean, my son's sort of on the going towards teenage, and it shows, you know. But it's
really?
Great, you know. Yeah, but he's starting to talk back and all, which is great, you know. But so yeah, it's just going through all that and all.
Wow.
You know, so.
Wow. So you would see love as the foundation then, Stephen?
Yes, I do see love as the foundation. Yeah. But yeah, love. I mean, again, I suppose it's.
It's open to interpretation, isn't it? But
yes, and I don't think it's a carte blanche either, you know, I've got to say. I don't think it's a sort of just, you know, love. Oh, I think it's much deeper than we believe. And it is an open interpretation. But even you and me may have different interpretations. But to me, that shouldn't stop us connecting either. Mm. You know, we have to ride the waves of all these things. And because, you know, if you look at nature, you know, the trees coexist, you know, so we need to learn to coexist in the way that nature does as well, you know.
Yeah, the forests aren't all just pine or just elm or just oak.
Exactly, you know.
Wow.
So.
It's been good to talk to you, mate.
Yeah, it's been good.
I've really enjoyed it.
John. Yeah.
Love to get together and pick some of this out a little bit more over a coffee or a beer or something.
Definitely.
Stephen, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem.
I've really enjoyed this. I've enjoyed listening and catching up with where you're at.
Time really flies.
I know. Yeah. I know we could probably keep going, but...
Yes, I know, yeah.
But we've got stuff to do.
All right, John. Yeah.
My dog will have its legs crossed now.
All right.
Cheers, Stephen.
All right, John. Thank you then. All right, see you soon.